across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
I am indeed at the Lake Wissota studio, and it's another beautiful day to have you here up north. Good morning, Wisconsin. It is 6:06 on this Friday morning, August 2nd. Love having you here from wherever you're listening across the Civic Media Radio Network, through the app, through social media, by podcast. Nice to have you here as we wrap up another work week. I've got a question for you. What's your weirdest coffee cup? And this is just a verbal, not a visual question to Greg Bach, because we're still working to make Coffee Cup Friday a thing. Although I'm starting to think maybe it's Monday. Maybe we start the week off that way, you know, because we all need a cup of coffee there, Mr. Bach. Yeah. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm fine. I once upon a time was in Italy and visited the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and as a result, have a leaning coffee cup.
Oh, that looks
looks dangerous. There's a reason there's not coffee in this coffee cup this morning.
Yeah.
I could try to drink out of it, but I think it would dribble right down, you know, one side of my chin.
That's why,
yeah, kind of turn the leaning coffee cup.
That leaning edge towards your mouth. Oh my God, I'd use that coffee cup all that time.
You'd have to put it right down the middle.
Yep.
Basically,
yep.
You know, and at that point, you may as well put a little spout on it, and it's a measuring cup. So, Leaning Tower of Pisa coffee cup. I'm telling you, they probably knocked that tower off just to make it a tourist trap. The way that it is, because it really is. If you've been there or to other these places, I mean, you see that for a few seconds, you go, oh yeah, that tower's leaning. And then the whole rest of the time, it's, you know, t-shirts, trinkets, you know.
Please don't take dirty pictures around it. I've seen videos of like guards like wishing people off, like, no, this is a family thing. This is a family thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's that. We went with the more traditional one where you look like you're trying to hold it up.
Yeah.
You know, where you put your hand just so.
Yeah.
Anyway, more fun with travels. Here's what's coming up on the program today. We'll talk a bit about the Kamala Harris agenda. What could we expect if the vice president were to win this November? We'll talk to Courier Newsroom national political correspondent Kia Vakil, who reports from L.A. on how the vice president's policy agenda targets relief toward middle-class workers and consumers, include things like an expanded child tax credit. That actually could have been passed yesterday, but Republicans in the Senate voted it down, despite a strong bipartisan vote in the House. In the House, something passed on a strong bipartisan vote, and Republicans in the Senate killed it. We'll talk a bit about that. In our second hour, more about a possible Harris presidency, or at least we'll talk about the campaign, and more about a prosecutor running for president against a convicted criminal. We'll talk to former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel about how Kamala Harris's time as a district attorney, as an attorney general, as a U.S. senator, as a vice president, and all that time spent prosecuting criminals might help her with moderate voters. And then Mark Jacob will break down some of the, shall we say, abysmal media coverage of former President Trump's meltdown in front of black journalists. And then we will talk about the first week of the Olympics with Dan Schumacher as well. Along the way, feel free to join us, 855-75-CIVIC. Again, 855-75-CIVIC. Or you can text us at that number. Or you can use the app, the Civic Media app, and send us a note. I was just bringing that text window up now so that I didn't miss anything there. 6 a.m. temperatures. Go something like this. It is 66 here on Lake Wissota with some very light fog, pretty much dissipated by now. Hayward's at 58, Park Falls 57, Wausau 64, Green Bay 70, La Crosse 70, Wisconsin Rapids, you're at 65 degrees, Oshkosh 70, Madison 67, and where Greg is in Waukesha, it is at 64 degrees right now. Any Olympic viewing from you last night when Simone Biles took the all-around gold medal?
No, I was actually at the club. We did a benefit for Alzheimer's of Wisconsin, and I was not able to view. But I'm going to watch them this weekend. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, there'll be plenty of highlights. She's Simone Biles.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that you saw 3 years ago when she had what they called the twisties, long gone. And they talked about her old age. You know, she's the oldest to win a gold medal in the all around in like nearly 70 years or something like that. She's 27.
Yep. Yeah, that feels good.
Grandma won a gold medal. Good job. I would argue that, again, she and some of the others who've been who are now in their 20s or early 30s, they've only gotten better, you know, because you learn more about what you've got to do, and you become, you know, more muscular in the right ways, in the ways you need to. I would put, you know, the grace and the strength of her moves up against anything that she did when she won a gold medal 8 years ago in this. As far as other updates, and I know I have them here we go from overnight because of the time differences. American sprinter Sha'Carri Richardson has advanced in her preliminary heat in the 100-meter sprint. She ran the 100 meters in 10.94 seconds, 0.2 of a second faster than the next highest finisher, so that'll put her in the semifinals tomorrow. Katie Ledecky went through her preliminary heat in the 800-meter free. The final will take place tomorrow night, and that could lead to her third gold medal of the Olympics and her fourth consecutive gold medal in that event. She swims real good.
Yeah.
I watched her in something yesterday.
That lady right there, Pat, she's a good swimmer.
Yep. She swims real good. I'll just be amazed at the performance of some of these folks. And hey, good on them. They've been very fun to watch. Yeah. Now, if you can't make it to Paris this weekend, and there's a chance that you can't, and maybe you can't be, you know, maybe you're going to be on the road looking for, you know, some place to go, might I consider suggesting to you the Jackson County Fair, where, look, I know there's county fairs all over the place. What's so special about the one in Jackson County? Well, when Selena Heller from Jackson County first joined us at Up North News, one of her very first stories really got my attention about something at the Jackson County Fair. We've all heard of demolition derbies. Okay, we're used to that. Demolition derbies with cars. I've even seen them with school buses. Combines. A combine demolition derby. The video is insane. The photos are crazy. Needless to say, these are not brand new combines, which now cost, what do they cost? Like, you know, maybe a couple $100,000 or something like that. These are monster machines, you know, but they, you know, old ones die. They end up in junkyards. You know, these things are, they go like 16,000 to 18,000 pounds and they max out at 18 miles an hour. But you know, you think a demolition derby at 18 miles an hour ain't going to be that good. It is when it's a combine. It's pretty fun, you know. So, and it's also, did you just send me a note, $500,000 for a combine?
Yep.
Oh, boy. I mean, I totally believe it. I mean, I've seen these things. I just hadn't priced one out. But here's the thing, that combine derby has become so popular that it is the main way that Jackson County affords to put on all the rest of the fair because of the ticket sales to see the combine. The winner of the derby gets $2,000. Other prizes total just under $4,000 total. But the drivers told Selena, it's not about the money. It's about taking the stress out. It's the fun of taking something out of the junkyard or near the junkyard and getting it running well enough to run one more time. And what a time it is. So I love that story so much. I just did not expect that to come in when I first saw it a year ago. And Selena sent a note to remind folks that it's the Jackson County Fair is this weekend as well.
That's fantastic. So, I just love that. Just the idea. Here's $2,000 of enjoy paying for gas for your new combine for 3 weeks.
Yeah, right. Text on the line from Matt in Germantown that says to Greg, thanks for doing an Alzheimer's benefit. I am the co-chair for the Walk to End Alzheimer's of Washington County.
Wonderful. So, excellent.
Matt, thank you for recognizing Greg and everybody. What else is happening at the Laughing Tap?
We got Jacob Williams for one show tonight, one show tomorrow. He has been on the show Wild and Out, and he was also on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Very funny guy. Looking forward to it. Both shows, 7:30. You can get your tickets at laughingtap.com. $22 online, $25 at the door. No drink minimums, my friends. We don't make you do stuff when you walk. We just want you to laugh.
That's all we ever want.
That's just. Can I just get some laughter, Pat? Can we just get some laughter? Dang, more laughter.
He laughed nervously because it was on demand.
Okay, now look at me in my eyes.
I did my best. Stop it. Look away. Look away. Let's see. The Brewers were off yesterday. They will open up a series tonight in the nation's capital to take on the Washington Nationals. Three-game series there begins when, Pat? Let's see. The pregame is at 5:10 tonight, and then the game itself is at 5:45. Well, that's great, Pat, but where can I hear the Brewers game? Well, Pat, here's where. On these Civic Media stations, WRCE in Richland Center, WRJN in Racine, Kenosha, WCQM in Park Falls, WISS in Oshkosh. For the Brewers, who, again, it's a three-game series in Washington against the Nationals. They will then be off on Monday as they travel to Atlanta for a three-game series there. The Brewers are back home a week from tonight to start a long homestand, 3 against Cincinnati, 4 with the LA Dodgers in town, and then 3 more the following weekend against the Cleveland Guardians. So a lot to see at American Family Field and a lot to hear on some of your favorite Civic Media stations. A reminder that absentee voting is underway now, and it is an important election that is taking place in Wisconsin on August 13th. It would normally be somewhat of a sleepy primary, but we have a contentious Republican primary in the 8th Congressional District. We have a contentious Democratic primary in the 3rd Congressional District. There are quite a fair number of legislative primaries because of new boundary lines. We have new, fairer maps, but it has led to primaries in several districts, and we'll try to review some of those next week. But a reminder that early voting is already underway on that, and the 2 state constitutional amendments where Republicans want the ability to plug up even more money and prevent federal aid from going to places where it's needed. So if you'd like to vote in that and the other primaries, you can either vote on August 13th or you can go vote early. Go to myvote.wi.gov to learn where to vote, what's on your ballot, how to register, how to check whether you're registered or not, and also to get an absentee ballot or vote in person at your local clerk's office. Your local clerk controls the hours of in-person early voting, so check in with them to get the latest. We'll talk about a voting database snafu in Georgia and more when we unpack the news coming up next on Up North News Radio, live from Lake Wissota on the Civic Media Radio Network. Loggins giving us the intro to This Is It on, of course, a Yacht Rock Friday. Here on Up North News Radio, Alicia Saunders puts in on Facebook, I got my vote in on Wednesday. I voted no on both amendments. Alicia, thanks for doing your part. Of course, it might have something to do with her prominent place on her local ballot. Whether you're on the ballot or not, head out and vote either early or on August 13th for that primary and that statewide referendum on 2 constitutional amendments. In Georgia, things not going so well as part of a Republican plan that they claimed was going to lead to more integrity in the voter rolls. Georgia election officials had created a state website to cancel the voter registrations when someone moves out of the state or dies, which, again, doesn't happen to the level that it would actually affect the results of an election. But Republicans have made a big deal about it and said that it would alleviate concerns about invalid registrations on the voter rolls. But Monday's rollout in Georgia was marred by a glitch that allowed people to access any voter's date of birth, driver's license number, and last 4 digits of their Social Security number. So they had to take it offline for a bit and make some fixes. And I'm not here to tell you that was done with any kind of intention. I'm just here to say, again, it was unnecessary. and that it is only going to feed a narrative of voter distrust of voting. And if some people see that this glitch and see that it leads other people to decide not to register to vote, they're not going to be bothered by it, because voter suppression has been part of their playbook for a long time now. And it just, again, leads to the prospect of considering that the people who are whining the loudest about non-existent voter fraud should maybe be trusted the least to be the caretakers of the voter rolls. There was a vote in Washington yesterday about tax policy, and specifically an extension of the child tax credit. And much like the border security bill, it had bipartisan support once upon a time. And actually passed the House of Representatives on an overwhelmingly bipartisan vote, something we've almost never said about the House of Representatives over the past 2 years that Republicans have been in control. Sounds like a slam dunk, right? But no. Senate Republicans blocked that legislation to cut taxes for working families and even extend some corporate tax breaks, one of their big priorities. And it died because they still think that they could end up taking the Senate as well as the House, and perhaps the White House with Donald Trump, and they want to wait to try to get an even bigger tax cut for businesses next year. The bill that was defeated was a $79 billion package that would have expanded eligibility for the child tax credit among the lowest income families and adjust the payments for inflation. It would have improved certain business tax credits like deductions for research and development and investments in equipment. And again, it passed with a bipartisan majority vote in the House. But Senate Republicans said they think they could write an even more conservative tax bill next year if they win control of Congress and the White House. Now, some Republicans, rightfully so, blasted them for that and said, why wouldn't you take the win that's right in front of you? If you win control next year and you want to build on that, you can. But to turn down any kind of progress whatsoever, I mean, you're gambling with people's lives. You're gambling with their checkbook, their pocketbooks, by denying them, whether they're families or business owners, the advantages they could have received from such a bipartisan bill. Now, to be fair, there were people on both sides who were against the bill because it didn't go far enough. When it passed the House overwhelmingly, 357-70, the split included people like Democrats Mark Pocan and Gwen Moore, who voted no because the family tax credits didn't go far enough and maybe the business credits were too generous. And Tom Tiffany voted no, again, probably for the same reason that Senate Republicans voted no yesterday and blocked it, because they wanted more tax cuts for business. And it just reminds you that while I am always the first one to warn people not to both sides a lot of issues, but usually there is one side that's more responsible than the other, and in this case, it's Senate Republicans who are responsible for this bill dying, there is definitely room for the argument that there are some Democrats as well as some Republicans who wouldn't accept incrementalism at this point. And incrementalism, forgive the language, but yeah, it sucks when you want more, when you want an even further expanded child tax credit or even further expanded business breaks. But in a Congress that is split like this, when you've got a chance to get that half a loaf or starve, and you're not the one starving, but other people are, you can understand some of the frustration on this bill, on the border bill, and others. But at least some of these folks in their opposition to it are being truthful about their opposition. Contrast that with J.D. Vance, Donald Trump's running mate, who had this to say the other day in trying to criticize Vice President Kamala Harris and others who he considered not to be pro-family enough.
One more thing I want to say on this trade, I think a lot of parents and a lot of non-parents look at our public policy over the last 4 years and ask, how did we get to this place? How did we get to a place where Kamala Harris is calling for an end to the child tax credit?
Kamala Harris never called for an end to the child tax credit. And reporters looked all around to see, did she have like a symbolic vote on an amendment or something like that? No, it's just a straight up false claim. The kind of thing that somebody like a J.D. Vance would do is just either get it wrong or make things up. Kamala Harris has always supported an expanded child tax credit because it works. It worked. It was expanded during the pandemic, and the level of child poverty in this country dropped dramatically. So many children were not living in poverty for a time. And when the time came to make that permanent, too many Republicans said, nope, that's welfare, and plunged those families back below the poverty level. Said, that's welfare, as they fought again and again and again to expand the corporate welfare of trillions of dollars in tax breaks for corporations. We'll have more to say about that throughout the course of the coming weeks as well. There will be new unemployment numbers coming up just about an hour from now, where we'll see how the economic recovery goes. Forecasters say that the number may be healthy, but maybe not as strong as it was last month. So we will monitor that. But when we come back, we'll talk to Courier Newsroom national political correspondent Kia Vakil about what might be part of a Harris administration if Kamala Harris were to win election as president this November. Wherever you're listening across Wisconsin on this Friday morning, when you're here, you're up north. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Welcome back to Up North News Radio on this Friday morning. Courier Newsroom national correspondent Kia Vakil is with us now to talk about some of the stories of the past week. Kia, how are you?
I'm pretty good, Pat. How about yourself?
Pretty good. I know that you, now you, I mean, it's been a little busy lately, so I can't count you among the Olympics couch potatoes, correct?
You cannot, unfortunately, although I've heard someone was telling me today about this Peacock Gold Zone that just kind of shows it's like NFL Red Zone, but for the Olympics, right, which makes me kind of want to turn that on and have it on in the background while I work. But no, I have unfortunately not been able to watch much of the Olympics due to the time zone difference, the craziness of working in news, and just me being surprisingly busy at night.
Go figure. The problem with the time difference, though, is that since I work from home, out of the corner of my eye in the afternoon, I could see things like Simone Biles winning the gold medal. But then I have to keep my yap shut for when Sherry gets home and we're watching it in prime time and to not say anything one way or another. So, you know, Olympics can mess with you that way. Anyway, we've got another week of that to go, and hopefully things continue to go well in Paris. Now, one of the big national and international news stories of the past 24 hours has been the release of the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich from Russia, along with another other foreign hostages, American and otherwise. That is a very positive development considering where we all thought things were stuck with Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, it's hugely positive news, particularly obviously for those folks, Evan Gershkovich, Paul Whelan, and the other folks released, and their families. You know, I can't imagine what it's like to have like your son or daughter or your dad or brother or sister wrongfully imprisoned all the way across the world, and to be able to do nothing about it. And so those folks today might well be the best day of their lives. And I think that's something we need to sit with for a second. But, you know, zooming out, what that means is, you know, Trump has been trying to play politics with this. It was last month or the month before where he was saying that, you know, on day one, he'd basically get Gershkovich released. He'd negotiate the best deal ever. And, you know, we already see this on Thursday where, you know, he's freaking out on Truth Social, trying to spread lies about it. Basically, like, you can tell he's really mad because he loses this like political football, even though it's people's lives we're talking about. So, you know, the Biden administration got it done. They navigated a really complicated set of negotiations
today, not tomorrow,
involving think it was seven countries.
And yes, seven different countries. Even as all the drama was going on about, does Joe Biden do anything and can he keep doing the work? He was doing the work right up until including that morning, that Sunday morning when he made the announcement that he wasn't running. He was still in communication with other nations to try to work this out. I think history is going to be a lot kinder to President Biden than people think. And this story is just one of many episodes.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I also think, you know, on, you know, now that he's decided not to run, you know, the main thing, you know, that he was getting negative coverage about, sort of the thing that was really coloring, you know, perspective on him, one of the main things at least, is now off the table. And it'll just be his administration and his accomplishments that they look at. Obviously, there's things, you know, that people have been upset about still, but this is a huge deal. Like, getting American prisoners home is a huge deal. And so, you know, it shouldn't be a political football, but obviously we live in an era where everything is a political football.
Yeah, without a doubt. So now he did make that decision, and Vice President Harris is the presumptive Democratic nominee. And yes, when you're a part of a team, in this case, the Biden-Harris administration, you share all of the ups and downs that come with it. But even though they have a lot in agreement, Kamala Harris is also her own person, and she's going to have her own priorities, even on things where they might agree on. What kinds of things do we think we know about what a Harris policy agenda would look like?
Yeah, so she's always been really, really, you know, prioritized things like addressing child care, addressing elder care, addressing paid, like creating a paid leave program. These are things she talked about a lot when she ran for president. These are things she's, you know, introduced bills to protect, you know, domestic workers and farm workers. She, you know, these sorts of low wage workers who really the economy runs on, frankly, if we're being honest, they are really underpaid. They have very few benefits, very few protections. So she's been, you know, that's a focus. Childcare is astronomically expensive or just incredibly difficult to find, or both in this country. And so in a day and time where, you know, a lot of people, you know, it's rare that you can kind of get by on, you know, one income as a household. So, and if you have kids, you know, you need childcare. And, you know, she really wants to address that. That's another thing she's talking about. We saw her talk about sort of adopting President Biden's position on capping rent increases and taking on corporate landlords, which, again, another huge cost for people is housing and rent. So we're seeing her really hone in on a couple really high, you know, high ticket costs for families. And that's important because, you know, the president can't fix everything economically, but they can push for these national programs to really help lower people's bills.
And of course, reproductive health care rights has been something near the top of the agenda, which takes us to our next topics, because there have been some setbacks this week, both in Iowa, where a ban took effect, and in Utah, where an abortion ban has been upheld.
Yeah, so in Iowa, the state Supreme Court a couple weeks back, you know, upheld a 6-week ban. We knew this was coming, unfortunately. This means women in Iowa, a lot of whom, you know, before they even realize they're pregnant, are not going to be able to get abortions after 6 weeks. And they're going to have to travel out of state to get care. That is, we know why that's a problem for women and for everybody. It's hard to find childcare. It's hard to take time off work. You know, it's expensive sometimes. So it is, you know, it's just another situation where Republican controlled states are just one, you know, piece by piece stripping people of their rights. And, you know, that's a travesty. And in terms of Utah, you know, we saw the Utah Supreme Court issue a ruling on their abortion ban. Although this one, you know, it did say that, you know, the ban, which is currently suspended, can remain suspended while a challenge to the law proceeds. So currently abortion is, you know, legal until I believe it's the 18th week of pregnancy in Utah. So, you know, that's a small win, but, you know, long-term, you know, it's likely that that conservative court in Utah will ultimately ban abortion as well.
And so we continue on with the checkerboard approach. yep. to abortion. And that takes us to one of the states where there's discussion of having the voters decide these things rather than, you know, politicians in judges' robes. And so in Florida, I get the sense from headlines there that support is building for that kind of a referendum to be held on abortion rights in Florida.
Yeah, I mean, there is going to be a ballot measure on the ballot in Florida that would effectively restore the Roe standard, which is, you know, abortion be legal until about 24 weeks, fetal viability. And that'll be up to voters. The tricky thing is Florida, their ballot measures require 60% approval to pass. So like a pretty significant majority. But there was a poll this week showing 69% of voters in Florida support the measure. So, you know, that clears that number easily. You know, it's likely to be a little bit closer than that. I think, you know, in either direction, a couple points, but it shows that abortion is broadly popular, even in Florida, where, you know, a lot of Democrats have written it off in the past couple of years, but it's not a red state. There's just a really robust Republican presence there, but there's a lot of people there who support abortion rights, who support legal marijuana, who want, you know, the government to address the housing crisis and the home insurance crisis. And, you know, there's an opportunity there for Democrats. It might not be this cycle, but, you know, it's not a state they should give up on. It's what, the third biggest state in the country? You can't just abandon it.
No, that would be bad. Although I think people have certainly been, shall we say, more realistic than in times past, but it just, like you said, means you work that much harder. And I think harder still in Florida, because if memory serves, there was some kind of a referendum or a constitutional referendum to restore voting rights to felons, and Governor Ron DeSantis did everything possible to undermine that. So even after the people vote, you know, you still have to keep an eye on some of these politicians who have shown over and over again they're willing to ignore the will of the voters.
Yeah, and that's very much of a piece with the party as a whole. They're trying to block ballot measures in all these states because they know abortion is popular. They are, you know, gerrymandering a bunch of states into oblivion. The Republican Party is not a pro-democracy party anymore. It is, they want their agenda. They want to make everyone else's lives look like what they want those lives to look like. They want to exert control, even if it's not democratic. And so that's where we're at right now in Florida. But voters, you know, have a chance at least to push back on abortion this fall.
Well, this topic takes us to Supreme Court reform, because, again, we've noticed our courts are getting more political all the time. And so President Biden, after, you know, working on this rather behind the scenes for years and years, is now coming forward with some plans that would reform the Supreme Court, perhaps federal courts beyond that. Take us through some of the proposed reforms that could conceivably come, at least become more likely in a Harris administration.
Yeah. So Biden on, I think it was Monday, earlier this week, let's say, announced in an op-ed in the Washington Post his plan to reform the Supreme Court. It's sort of a three-part plan. The first one would install 18-year term limits on the justices. So, you know, if it were to go into effect, a president every 2 years would appoint a new justice, which would basically mean no one president has more authority or power. Obviously, the election still matters, because if it's a Democratic president, they get to appoint a Democratic justice and vice versa. But it just, you know, prevents lifetime appointments for some of these really, you know, ideological justices. The second thing it would do is it would create a more binding, enforceable code of ethics that would require them to, you know, publicly disclose gifts they get. We saw, you know, reporting obviously on Clarence Thomas taking luxury trips, Samuel Alito as well, paid for by, you know, right-wing billionaires and people who had interest before the court. And, you know, that seems pretty unethical. But there's no real binding ethics code right now for the court and no enforcement mechanism. So Biden is trying to change that. Obviously, both of those would require congressional approval, which is not going to happen right now. But it, you know, it shows that there is a real movement, a growing movement, even in the moderate wing of the Democratic Party, to reform the Supreme Court, because institutionally it's an absolute disaster at this point. And then the last prong is just to push for a constitutional amendment following, you know, the court's decision last month to say, you know, the president can basically do whatever crimes they want if it's an official act. You know, Biden wants to push for a constitutional amendment to make clear that no American, not even the president, is immune to prosecution for crimes they commit.
We will conclude with the Republican candidate for governor in North Carolina. We are, and we'll close by talking about the Olympics, which was how we started here. And Simone Biles, of course, winning that second gold medal. But it reminds us that a few years back when Simone Biles was going through a rough patch and had to withdraw from competition in the Tokyo Games, Mark Robinson was not exactly sympathetic to her and frankly, well, a jerk, for lack of anything better I can say on the radio.
Yeah, he, you know, was mocking her for, you know, she was dealing with something, I believe it's called the twisties, where you can't tell up from down when you're doing gymnastics. Seems like a pretty big problem if you're flipping through the air. You don't want to, you know, land on your head, neck, or die. And so she bowed out of the 2020 Olympics. You know, Mark Robinson, big tough guy that he is, you know, basically just savaged her for it, suggesting she was weak, you know, that he was, you know, he handled problems differently, really just, you know, aggressively insulting her. You know, he has a record of really, you know, saying awful things about women. So it's not entirely shocking. And I'm not even sure that's in the top 10 of the worst things he said. but this is the world we live in now, where major Republican gubernatorial candidates are attacking Olympians, are attacking women, are trying to ban abortion, you know, are trying to again, it's exerting their control or their own beliefs over the whole country. That's what they want to do.
Yeah, and all I'd ask of Mark Robinson in return is to just try to get up on some of these apparatus and try to do 1% of what they do, and then maybe you can run your mouth at that point. Kiev Akil, Courier Newsroom national correspondent, thank you so much. Have a great start to the weekend. We'll talk to you later.
You too. Thank you.
And we'll be back with more in just a bit. This is Up North News Radio, live from Lake Wasota on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down a road and back again. Your heart is true, you're a pal and a confidant.
Let's start today's history lesson with a birthday. Happy birthday to Andrew Gold, who turns 73 years old today. Known for this hit, Thank You for Being a Friend, which was later turned into the opening of the Golden Girls. And also had the song Lonely Boy, which could only be judged in one radio host's view as one of the dumbest, most selfish songs that ever was allowed on the radio, about a lonely boy who claims to have been a victim because his parents love his sister more, starting when he was 2 years old. If you do the math in the song, like, since he was two, he resented his little sister getting attention. Shut up, Andrew. I'm glad you did the song about having friends. Or else I'd have more to say about that. But that's probably enough.
Pat has words.
I have words. Every time I hear Lonely Boy come on one of those, you know, stations, I'm just like, who keeps playing this? Anyway, on this day in 1962, Bob Dylan made his name change official, legally saying goodbye to his birth name, Robert Zimmerman, because he was making good money as Bob Dylan, making all kinds of songs like this one.
Maybe living in another country under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
It was coincidentally on this day in 1969, 7 years later, that Bob Dylan made a rare return to his hometown of Hibbing, Minnesota, to attend his 10-year high school reunion. He was accompanied by his wife, Sarah. He joined some classmates at the local Moose Lodge. And I guess it proved to be awkward because he never did make it to the reunion itself and didn't make any other public visits to his hometown.
Wow. Oh.
Yeah. Well, you know, some people, they get a little bit of fame.
Yeah.
There you go. Let's see. The number one song this day in 1975. I mean, the Eagles were riding as high as it gets during those years. And This was their number one hit this day 49 years ago. Oh dear! While the intro plays to this, I'm realizing that Robert Zimmerman changing his name to Bob Dylan did not sit well with Tony Zimmerman up in Ashland, who puts the comment on YouTube, "What kind of punk is too good for Zimmerman?"
And that's a live stream comment from Mr. Tony Dylan of up north, right, of Wisconsin. Tony. Thanks, Tony Dylan. Tony Dylan, thanks for always watching and listening.
Tony Dylan. Oh, he's not going to let you forget that one. On this day in 1937, the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937 is passed by Congress, rendering marijuana and all of its byproducts illegal. Still the case in Wisconsin, where here Republicans like to party like it's 1937.
That's funny.
We got birthdays today. Mary Louise Parker is 60 years old today. Over the weekend, we've got some birthdays. Tomorrow, Martin Sheen turns 84. Martha Stewart turns 82 tomorrow. On Sunday, former President Barack Obama turns 63. And Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, does she still have that title? Probably not. Is she back to Meghan Markle? She is 42 years old coming up this weekend. On this day in 1978, Boston released their second album. Here's the title track from that one. This, of course, is Don't Look Back, and like their first album, it's mostly recorded in the basement studio of Boston's Tom Scholz.
It's an amazing story, that band. That man, mm-hmm. Amazing.
It reached 1 million in sales in its first 10 days. Jeez. And has sold more than 7 million overall in the years since. Fast forward two more years to 1980, and the movie Xanadu, which failed miserably, but still had a pretty good soundtrack thanks to cuts like this from Olivia Newton-John, the number one song this day in 1980. Come take my hand. You should know. On this day in 2010, Arcade Fire released The Suburbs, their third studio album. On this day in 2019, Ed Sheeran was on his Divide tour, and he broke U2's record for highest grossing tour of all time. Here's one of the hits that Ed continues to play on tour.
Sounds very U2-ish.
It does, doesn't it?
I think of that. I'm 6 years old, I broke my leg.
Now, of course, this was 2019 when he had the record that day for highest grossing tour of all time. By now, of course, Taylor Swift has that title.
Yeah.
But 5 years later, Sheeran's tour is still top four on the list. So here's the top five right now for highest grossing tours of all time. So U2, their 360 tour grossed $736 million. Sheeran's Divide tour had actual gross ticket sales of $776 million. Coldplay is at number three. Their Music of Spheres tour is still going on, and they've grossed $810 million so far. Number two, Elton John's Farewell tour. It lasted for 5 years and made $940 million. And then you've got Taylor Swift's Eras tour, which is closing in on $1.1 billion and counting. And she's done that in only 60 shows. 60. Elton John's Farewell tour, 330 shows. Ed Sheeran, 255 shows. Taylor Swift makes $1 billion in 60 shows.
Oh, my God.
She is just her own part of the global economy.
Yeah.
It is International Beer Day today. It is National Ice Cream Sandwich Day. It is Water Balloon Day, Coloring Book Day, National Farmers Market Week is coming up next week. And, of course, National Sandwich Month continues. So here's today's National Sandwich Month hot take. One of my favorite sandwiches is either a hot turkey or a hot beef sandwich with either the turkey gravy or the beef gravy poured over the top. But is it really a sandwich? Because it's served open face. It's just the bread and the meat and the gravy. Discuss. And everybody's like, no, I don't want to discuss this. Whoever thought that was a sandwich, but it's always referred to as a hot turkey sandwich.
In the coming weeks, I will bring up the term open face, and I will also bring up a sandwich. I know my opinion will be controversial. We don't have time for it today, but I have thoughts on things.
I'm gonna. That's your new subtitle. Greg Bach there, Pat Kreitlow here. This is Up North News Radio. Jim Santel, Mark Jacob, and Dan Schumacher all ahead on this.